A proud of it, Sriedzva. Everyone, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Russian for "the end justifies the means," which refers to something we'll get to later in the show. I am Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Not too bad. Want justice for Charles, but beyond that, I'm having a pretty good week.
Having a busy week is Danny O'Dwyer. He is still moving house, as he says. I had a pretty busy week too. I just wanted to use this podcast as yet another platform to plug my fundraising efforts. I am raising money for MS research. I rode my bike this weekend from San Francisco to Wine Country, and am raising money to help support research for multiple sclerosis, because I have two friends that have MS. So I figured I need to blast this on as many outlets as possible. If you'd like to support the cause, you can go to bikingwhiteguy.com. We've already raised over $25,000, which is absolutely insane. So thank you, everyone, if you've already donated. Thank you to listening to this podcast. If you're new here, welcome. If you're new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge and sort of gives a lowdown on the sport, who everybody is, how it all works. And if you want to do that, this year's primer episode is episode 59. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience at patreon.com/shiftf1, where we every month release at least one bonus podcast and bonus video just for our patrons, which covers racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, all kinds of weird stuff. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all that, you can head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. Today, however, we have a packed episode. We'll be discussing two races, the one that just happened in Singapore and the upcoming one in Sochi. So what do you say, Rob? Let's hop right in, shall we?
Absolutely.
Practice. Perez crashed, had to replace his gearbox and earned himself a 5-place grid penalty. But I think the biggest story from the pre-race events was that Ferrari is trying out a new front wing and a new floor, which I think surprised everyone, especially when they got to qualifying, just how fast they were. I think I, at least last week, tried to say that Ferrari probably not going to be too competitive. And then you chimed in and said, I don't know about that. And I think history was on your side, Rob.
Well, I think this was a case of now Ferrari doing a bit of sandbagging themselves, right? If memory serves, they had come out of the last two races, and after Monza, they were really playing the expectations game, where they were saying, hey, look, those are probably our best circuits. The car isn't going to be on very good form at a circuit like Singapore. From what we've seen of the Ferrari to date, that seemed reasonable, but these upgrades may have been game-changing for a track like this. And that was something that Ferrari were definitely downplaying.
Yeah, well, they couldn't hide it anymore when we got to Q3, because Charles Leclerc earned his third pole position in a row. His eighth time in a row out qualifying his teammate Sebastian Vettel. So, good news for him. Bad news for Daniel Ricciardo, who was disqualified from qualifying after his MGUK over-revved and gave too much power. Do you understand what happened here, Rob?
Not entirely, but it appears to me that there was too much electrical power discharged over the course of one of his laps. It wasn't happening throughout the session. It was happening in Q1. Maybe only on one lap. And so you are limited to a certain amount of power per lap, and he exceeded that just a little bit on one lap.
Yeah, the team said that, according to them, Ricciardo gained a 1 microsecond advantage, which is 0.000001 seconds.
No, it was a ridiculous penalty. That said, I think he took a difficult situation and made it worse. Like, this was a, as we'll talk about in the race, sometimes you do get screwed by officiating in F1. The thing that's not going to help is just being enraged about it for the rest of the race weekend, however long that's going to be. And I think this hit Ricardo on some level where, like, the red mist descended and didn't really lift until the end of the race.
Yeah, and I guess just to, we should have said this at the top, but an email here from Michael asking us to describe exactly what this whole system is. He says, I'm not entirely sure what an MGUK even is. Autosport mentioned that it was the MGUK exceeding a 120 kilowatt limit, but that Daniel Ricciardo says he thinks it was just a curb strike. So the MGUK stands for motor, or the motor generator unit kinetic. There's also the MGUH, which is heat. So through kinetic energy and heat energy, the car actually regenerates that energy into battery power. So kinetic energy from the wheels and heat energy from the waste of the engine get converted into battery power that is stored in the car for dispersal throughout the lap. So if the regulations say, Appendix 3 per Article 5.2.2 of the 2019 Formula One regulations, that only so much energy is supposed to be coming from the MGUK. And this is something that I guess, you know, with all the technology that is packed into these cars, you hit a curb and it it jolts it a little bit and can over rev into the red and out of.
It's out a bizarre, like, this would make sense to me if these things were incredibly hard to detect and therefore it seemed like a clear opportunity for abuse of the rules or cheating. Like, so if we catch somebody doing this, we have no choice but to punish them as hard as possible to make the risk versus reward calculation completely out of whack. But that doesn't appear to be the case because obviously they were able to get this data pretty easily and figure out that there'd been this excessive discharge over the course of a lap. I don't understand. This is one of those cases where it feels like somebody should have been around to make a judgment call about what to do with this. But throwing away his qualifying over the issue was pretty excessive, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think Ricardo offered, you know, couldn't I just have had that lap time deleted instead of being disqualified?
Yeah, he even said, like, I would understand if it had happened throughout qualifying, then yeah, obviously it's an issue, but it was just one lap time in Q1, which the Renault was going to beat anyway, and then it didn't
happen. Yeah, it wasn't even his fastest lap.
Yeah. So, no, it's a very strange rule, and it indicates the degree to which sometimes Formula One just gets in its own way with not necessarily, I don't even say this is necessarily like overregulation, but it is a lack of flexibility in how those rules are assessed and adjudicated, especially when here it's not a live race situation. You have the luxury of like sitting back, discussing, talking it over with stakeholders. So being this heavy-handed is weird to me.
Yeah, and I didn't detect a whole lot of sympathy from race director Michael Massey, who says, when it comes to technical infringements, it is a technical infringement, end of story. While I can feel for Daniel, it was an error, and sadly, it is what it is. I think we're treading on dangerous territory, personally, when we're starting to, with technical infringements in particular, build in margins in upon margins upon margins. But I think that just speaks to what you said, Rob, and kind of what we've been saying for a lot of this season is that, the rules could use a little more flexibility built into them because they're the black and white way that they're written now. Results in stuff like this. But sorry for Ricardo. He'll be starting from the back of the grid. Do you, Rob, want to take us through the start of the race?
Oh, gosh. My notes here are a little spotty because I'm jotting things down as quickly as possible during the start of the race. First thing to note, as always, it is hot as hell at this race, but people were commenting it was a particularly brutal night.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. We should run down the how the grid looked.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so Charles Leclerc on pole, Lewis Hamilton right behind him, and Sebastian Vettel in third spot. Max Verstappen in fourth. Then we've got Valtteri Bottas, Alex Albon, Carlos Sainz, Nico Hülkenberg, Lando Norris, and Antonio Giovinazzi rounding out the top 10. Pierre Gasly's in 11th, followed by Kimi Raikkonen, Kevin Magnussen, Danny Kvyat, Sergio Perez, Lance Stroll, Roman Grosjean, George Russell, Robert Kubica, and then Daniel Ricciardo starting from the back.
Yeah, so Leclerc made a pretty clean getaway at the start of all this. And then Vettel really went right after Hamilton, pretty much out of the gate. In the first turns, he was really pushing Hamilton hard, and that basically meant that Leclerc got to drive away, like pretty easily. But there was a lot of bumping and grinding in the midfield, I guess is the way you put it. You had George Russell sort of hobbling around the track with a broken front wing, dragging off the nose of his car. It looks like Gasly made a nice move on Raikkonen and edged past him with some outbraking in, I think, turn two, was it?
I don't remember.
But either way, Hülkenberg had to pit immediately due to an incident he had on the first lap.
Yeah, with signs.
Yeah, Russell also in. Did you see what had happened with Grosjean? He was being looked at by the stewards for something he did in turn one at the start of the race.
I didn't end up seeing what that was, no.
Yeah.
But the Hülkenberg signs contact was declared a racing incident, so no one got any penalties for that. And I think similar for the Ricciardo-Russell contact. Russell did have to change his front wing, though.
Right, and that's where Ricciardo starts already. Like, he had a kinetic day, which I suppose is appropriate given that that was the part that kind of screwed him in this race. But right from the first, he was trying to make up a lot of lost ground early and maybe being less patient than he could have and should have been. And so, yeah, he has that turn one incident. Sainz, his race just becomes a nightmare. Following that contact, he pulls into the pits. And was there something wrong with the nut, or did he fall off the jack? They couldn't get the right rear
reattached. Yeah, I think he was, because of the puncture, he was driving on the rim, and so they maybe couldn't get the jack under the car to bump it up.
Yeah,
that may have been what happened.
Yeah, he was stuck stationary in the pits for 42.4 seconds
on the second
lap of the race. So he was pretty well toast from the jump. But in terms of action at the front, this became a weird race really quickly because it sorted out into a pretty clear order right from the start. Vettel had to back off of Hamilton. Verstappen stayed ahead of Valtteri Bottas. But usually, when somebody has clear air out front, the strategy is just go. Just put as much daylight between you and the rest of the pack as possible. And that's usually the winning strategy for a car with a competitive advantage and clear air in front of it. That's not what Ferrari did. That's not what Leclerc did. And it made for a... I would say this was one of the most fascinating, boring-ass races I've seen in Formula One, because I can't really think of a case where I've seen anything quite like this. Leclerc goes into like pace conservation mode and just keeps backing up the field. And he's trying to not take much out of his tires. And the theory was that he in the front, but also all the lead cars would have wanted this. They wanted to get to a place where a one stop was pretty much guaranteed to work well without the risk of a safety car screwing them over completely. And so the thinking was that Leclerc was just staying out there until basically he crossed the threshold where he could easily complete the race on a one-stop regardless of what happened. And at that point, he would be clear to go racing. But that did mean that for probably the first third of this race, there wasn't a lot of racing happening at the front. What there was a lot of radio messages from the front runners talking about how weird it was, and then also getting increasingly uncomfortable with how their tires felt. Because even though they were really conserving their pace, nevertheless, their tires were going off. Even Leclerc's were going off a bit. And so there was this growing vulnerability among the front runners for the first person to defect from that strategy would probably have a chance at cleaning up well, because it wasn't like they'd been holding onto their tires and therefore they could use the sweet spot at any moment. It was they were holding onto their tires and just slowly degrading them towards the edge of the cliff. And so it made for a strange dynamic at the start of this race. Hamilton, his engineers kept telling him to slow up, stay behind Leclerc. And Hamilton is on the radio saying, I am going as slow as possible. towards the back, Ricardo was carving his way forward through the field. I picked off Stroll at turn 7, I think on lap 7. And he pretty quickly made his way from, I think he started in
20th.
Dead last. Good Lord. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see. Yeah, you can sort of follow the lap chart. He had made up, like by lap 2, he'd made up 5 places. And then it was about a position every lap as he sort of picked his way forward through the field. So he was having a pretty classic Daniel Ricciardo race, I would say. And he was true to that form throughout in some ways. But any other notes? Yeah.
Yeah, early on, Kvyat pitted. Or I think he was kind of the first one he's not in that front pack, but I thought it was interesting. He pitted and his outlap was 2.5 seconds faster than the leader of the race, which just gives you an indication of how slow Leclerc was going. And I also thought that, you know, maybe something that played into Ferrari's tactics here is that Mercedes has been particularly susceptible to cooling issues. Bottas was told early to try to cool down his front left, even though they're not going super fast. Also, you know, this is a narrow track. The top 6 were getting DRS, but no one was passing. So, you know, everyone's just making enough time to stay ahead of everybody else. You're right. It was a really, really weird race. But on lap 16, Leclerc's engineer tells him to go back to mode race, and is told to push from there.
And this is where things begin to go a little haywire, because it turns out there's not much pushing left to be had. Leclerc goes into attack mode, but his performance is already pretty compromised. Hamilton's on the radio saying the same thing. Meanwhile, everyone who's pitted has ended up getting stacked behind the back markers. And so you end up with a situation where, like, towards the back, you've got Raikkonen, Perez, Kvyat, all stuck behind Kubica. And this track is so tough to overtake at that Kubica ends up fighting a pretty fun duel with those guys as he's going around. But that's sort of foreshadowing of you couldn't overtake Kubica in a Williams at this track without having to go, you know, at least 2 or 3 rounds with the guy. And that was kind of a sign of how important track position was going to be here.
And it's an indication. Well, it's again, part of that strategy, I think, because when you back up everybody else, when you got a big old train where everyone's close together, you can't pit because there's no gap to come out in. You're going to come out in traffic.
So Bottas goes on the attack on lap 19 with Verstappen, but that's mooted pretty quickly. One, there's just not, again, nobody has much life left in their tires. But on lap 20, right after Leclerc goes past the pit entrance, Vettel comes in. And then Verstappen follows him in immediately, and so the two are kind of racing down pit lane together. They both go to hards. Vettel comes out in P10, but he comes out ahead of Hulkenberg. Verstappen comes out in P12, and he is therefore behind Hulkenberg. So they've got Hulkenberg between them. And at this point, Hamilton is on the radio saying, "We've got to go for the undercut. We've got to pit now and use the undercut," because he saw what had happened.
Meaning Hamilton would come in, get new tires, and because those other tires are falling off everybody else, Hamilton, being much faster, would make up time on the people ahead of him. So he would then jump Leclerc, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, and this is, like, I think everyone was caught off guard by how strong the undercut was here. Everyone was caught off guard by how little was left in those tires, but, well, how off guard were they? How off guard was Ferrari, I guess, is a thing we'll debate later. But the advantage people got by being the first ones onto fresh rubber to those hards and then just like tearing ass around the track was pretty commanding, more dramatic than you're used to seeing at a Formula One track. Usually you can have a little bit left at the end of your tire life. That was just not the case here. Lap 21, Leclerc comes in. Hamilton has been told opposite Leclerc. So whatever Charles does in his Ferrari, Hamilton is going to do the opposite. So he has to stay out. And the idea is that it's the hammer time will work, even though that's not what Hamilton wanted. And they will try the overcut approach instead.
Right, because the window to undercut him has passed. So right. Now... they know they're going to do the opposite to Leclerc. So if Leclerc goes on and doesn't pit, that's the undercut. That's the time for Hamilton to pit.
Right.
But if Leclerc goes in, now is to try the overcut. But Hamilton's tires are so bad, it doesn't work.
Right. And we end up having a pretty good demonstration of the sunk cost fallacy. but the disaster happens for Leclerc. Even though he has a 2.4 second stop, and Hamilton, Vettel had kind of a slow one. He had a 3 second stop. Leclerc has a 2.4 second stop. He comes out behind Vettel. And he's gobsmacked to find himself staring at the back of his teammate and immediately is asking, "Hey, what just happened here? And what's the plan?"
Yeah.
And the team's pretty cagey about what the plan is. And they're just like, for now, keep position. And so Leclerc is trailing Vettel. Hamilton, meanwhile, has stayed out. But his laps are 2 seconds a lap slower than Vettel. So that same thing you were talking about with Kvyat. The tires are just done. Valtteri comes in, 2.9 second stop. He comes out in P9 behind Verstappen, ahead of Albon. So basically the pack is reshuffling in the running order it had before. So Hamilton is in a tough spot because at this point, the math on his pit stop is getting increasingly catastrophic. When he stops, he will fall in behind Verstappen. I think at that point he was lapping a 148.8, and lap times were down into like the 46s, I want to say. But it gets even a little hairier for Mercedes because then they tell Bottas, "Hey, you need to do a minute 48.8. Just." here's a number off the top of my head. It would be really good right now if you did the same lap as Hamilton, because they do not want to deal with, like, their thinking that they explained later was that if Bottas had undercut Hamilton, the car behind him, was it Albon at that point?
Yes.
Would have also followed him through. And Hamilton would have lost that position as well, because that's how badly things were going. And so what they needed Valtteri to do was basically maintain track position and back traffic up behind him so that Hamilton had a window where at least he wouldn't fall farther through the field when he came in. But either way, it was pretty much a disaster from the Mercedes strategy side.
The three most feared words of Valtteri Bottas, Valtteri, is James.
Yep.
When James Valls, the team strategist, has to come on the radio, you know it's bad.
Yeah. So on lap 27, they bring Hamilton in, and that puts Antonio Giovinazzi into P1.
Yeah! Get up there, Tony! This is apparently the first time a team outside of the top three has led a race in 4 years.
It's, and he stayed there for a little bit. But yeah, in the meantime, Vettel was definitely in his element. Flashes of Red Bull Vettel, I would say. He's confident that his car has a competitive advantage. He overtakes a lot of not necessarily backmarkers, but...
Yeah, because they're not getting blue flags. They are racing for position. They just haven't pitted yet.
Right. And so he does have to... And this is... The argument that Ferrari handed the race to Vettel, I think, is a little overstated. I think the other thing that Vettel did to moot the issue was that really quickly he started putting cars between himself and Charles. And Charles was following him through that traffic, but Vettel pretty much went on a tear and began scooping up all those positions to sort of claw his way into the lead while these cars who hadn't pitted slowly fell behind. But it was a pretty sharp performance from Vettel. He pretty quickly moved out of striking distance of Leclerc and stayed there. But it was kind of where I was at with this is if you've had misgivings about Vettel the last season or two, I don't necessarily think this race assuages them, because like the best things he did were things we've seen him do a million times, and it's always in the in the best car with a competitive advantage over the cars around him. He's very smooth and he makes good decisions. I don't think he was necessarily under the pressure that we sometimes see him in other races.
Yeah, and I mean, it was cool to see him weave through the traffic, but there was a move on Gasly that was real risky. I mean, he got it done, but I think there's a universe where that goes bad and we're here again talking about Vettel's poor form, right? And
that's true. Gasly doesn't go wide. Vettel does kind of a late break attack on Gasly, and Gasly has to cut pretty wide to avoid it. And that's a really good point. If Gasly were maybe not feeling so defensive right now, he might have contested that a bit.
But you're right. He does open up, Vettel does, a gap to Leclerc around about 6.2 seconds once Leclerc clears Giovinazzi. That's about the gap to Vettel. Elsewhere in the field, Ricciardo goes for a pass on Giovinazzi. And like you were saying, Rob.
Yeah, he hits Giovinazzi as he goes by, and it cuts his right rear. The other thing is this: Giovinazzi still hadn't pitted, right? Like, yeah. This was Ricciardo on fresh tire. Like, this is the move that you have the luxury of setting up and doing it at a less risky position. And Ricciardo had to force the issue, and it ends up basically he had driven a really excellent recovery race, and that basically trashes it. And I don't think that was the last, I'm not sure that was necessarily the last mistake he made. Oh, he got into a tussle with Kvyat later that he should not have gotten into. but yeah, so like this was one of those cases where Ricciardo was not showing a lot of discipline behind the wheel, and that dramatic attack we saw at the start of the race, I think he just stopped weighing the risk and reward as that race continued, and was trying to force things. And he could have picked off Giovinazzi at any time. He forced it, but we don't have much time to linger over that, because The camera cuts to Russell is in a wall due to Roman Grosjean shoving, sort of snowplowing him off.
Yeah. I watched this a couple of times, and I'm no scientist, but this really looks like Grosjean's fault. But he and Russell were both cleared of any wrongdoing after the race, the stewards saying, as the cars exited turn 8, the stewards determined that both cars held their line, but that those lines converged, and with both drivers racing hard,
which is to say
the collision
they didn't.
Resulted. The stewards determined that both drivers contributed to the incident, and that both drivers could have mitigated the incident.
I think that's, and honestly, I do think that's fair, although I do kind of wonder what Russell meant with that really sardonic, I should have guessed, reaction after he'd been knocked out of the race. It did seem like a racing incident, but to me it also looked like Grosjean was a little more at fault, and you do probably have something similar to the Ricciardo Giovinazzi dynamic, which is it's still a Williams at the end of the day. Like, you can give him that corner and get this done later. I don't know.
It's interesting. This is maybe a good opportunity to highlight our double standard, because Russell is technically supposed to leave a car's width, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that how this works? And so even though Grosjean can see what's happening happen, and in retrospect, it looks like, well, why didn't you just back off? Because you were going to cause a collision. Enough space was supposed to have been left.
Yeah.
So
it's a really, if memory serves, that's a pretty tight corner, and Russell was on the inside of that, and a bit like what we were talking about with Verstappen at Le Source a few weeks ago, you can actually only be so tight around that corner with these cars, and so I think pretty much once Russell was committed to that line, there was no way he was getting around that corner without coming over a bit into the danger zone for Grosjean.
Yeah, you can't make a turn in 0 feet.
Yeah, so I think Grosjean had more opportunity to avoid it. I don't think it's a totally cut and dried thing, but yeah, just not a great look. But that brings out the safety car.
Yeah, and worth pointing out that this is only the first retirement for Williams in 2019. Which I think is just an insult to injury.
That is why. Well, that's how they got their point. So safety car comes out. Leclerc wants to stop and get on fresh tires, but it's not even clear whether he really wants that or whether that is just him.
Do something.
Yeah, exactly. And at this point, like, now that he's under safety car, he begins like trying to get clarity. Hey, what just happened here? Am I getting the spot? Are you going to let me race? And they're telling him basically no. They tell him do not use the higher engine modes. And so he is restricted from, I think this is where he's having that conversation. No, that's during the second safety car. Okay. So Leclerc at this point is asking about tire strategy. And he's furious about how this is all played out. Lap 41, we have the restart. Gasly fends off an attack from Stroll. Hulkenberg gets past Stroll as he's sort of left exposed by his failed run at Gasly. Stroll locks up. Something has happened with Stroll. His left front is broken on replay. It looks like there's a corner that you sort of like crease the apex of. And Stroll got it wrong and just banged his suspension against the barrier and broke it. So not a great look for Stroll by any stretch.
He hasn't been confirmed for his seat next year either. So anything can happen.
Shit, technically that's still an open. Yeah. That is funny. But anyway, so Stroll.
Was it suspension or was it a tire? I have here in my notes it was a puncture, and he does finish the race, it seems.
Okay, it must have just been a puncture. It might have just been my note from in the moment. But that brings out another safety. Perez is slowing around the same time.
Yeah.
And he has to park near turn 14 and he can't make it to, he's literally basically there in the racing line.
Yeah.
And that brings out the safety car again a little later than I would like. Perez has time to get out of his car while cars are literally racing past him.
Yeah, they're waving yellows, but I know what you mean.
They were going fast, man.
Yeah.
It seemed a little sluggish for deploying the safety car for a driver being in that position. But anyway, so that brings out the safety car. As the safety car is ending, and it goes from lap 43 to lap 47, Leclerc is asking, can you give me full power? And he's told, no, we can't. We need you to be smart. And he begins getting into a debate with his Ferrari engineer about, what he means. Yeah, of course I'll be smart. Give me the full power. I'll be smart with it.
I want everything. We need to bring the car home, Charles. I won't do anything stupid. Yeah, we got an email here from Neil, actually, about this. He says, at the Singapore GP, there's a lot of discussion about what engine modes drivers had access, quote, to, especially Vettel and Leclerc. This was of particular note during one of the safety cars, the second, I think, when the commentators mentioned Leclerc had been given access to the K1 Plus mode, a mode somehow beyond the usual K1 engine mode he had previously. How exactly do the engine modes function, and how is access to the different modes controlled? Do the engineers have a method of enabling or disabling certain engine power functions, or is it a suite of options the drivers technically have access to at any time, but don't necessarily know the ideal settings? Thanks so much for the work you do with the podcast. Finding Shift F1 made me a racing fan this season, and I'm excited to see where things go from here. All the best, Neil. Thank you, Neil. I think I have only a few things to add here. I know that the cars cannot receive signals from the pits, so the engineers can't do things like restrict modes, but they can certainly see when a driver has switched to a certain mode. And these are done with the dials on, if you've ever seen a picture of a Formula One steering wheel, there are dials all over the place, and that's how you would switch to an engine mode. I also think that when you say an engine mode, a mode is a mapping, they call it, of where to deploy power and how much power to deploy. That's about the extent of my technical knowledge.
Yeah, actually, I don't know what the answer is here, because this is where I started to wonder about this too. Because it doesn't come up very often. The way it has always sounded, modes are controlled from the pits. But as you said, the rule is driver has to drive the car unassisted. So there's limits to what that control can look like.
Yeah, they're like pre-programmed profiles.
Right. So I was sitting there wondering, could Leclerc just go rogue and give himself max power in that car?
I think I think Vettel has done this in the past, where he was told mode multi 21. Isn't that what that was?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Usually it certainly seems like that is the nuclear option for a driver, because usually the team makes the call about that stuff and the driver just doesn't. I think that's also because the modes are touching on so many other components of the engine that there is data that the engineers are looking at that is immediately relevant to what mode you're in that the driver just is not going to have access to and is not going to see. And so drivers sort of contravening orders on that stuff could be really dangerous for things like the wear on parts, battery reserves, fuel, exactly. So it's a pretty extreme thing to do, but I don't know if drivers can do it. But it doesn't sound like Leclerc did. It sounds like, for all his anger about this, he did not force the issue.
Could you imagine if he did and then his engine exploded?
Like, it would have been the greatest thing ever. Content for days.
Yeah. The whole front page of Autosport is full.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a really tense conversation they're having. They end up not giving him the power. On the restart, Ricardo, now once again trying to sort of work his way back through the field, ends up getting into it with Danny Kvyat. And Kvyat just buries him in a wall. Doesn't, like, no contact, but there is, which corner is it? It's got the corner is wider than it is on its exit. And so there's a bit of a notch in the guardrail where, like, you sort of have, you can swing out wide, but then it funnels you back into the racing line a bit. He kind of forced Ricardo into that little nubbin and forced Ricardo to brake hard to avoid hammering that barrier. So not a great fight that Ricardo picked, putting himself in that position. Hulkenberg gets pretty elbows out with Magnussen at this point, which has interesting context around it. Yes, there's some good midfield action.
This is Kvyat and Raikkonen too, right?
Yeah, lap 50. Kvyat, was it turn one?
That sounds right. I think he's on the
real
inside.
Fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he breaks late and tries to dive inside Raikkonen. Raikkonen turns in on him. They hit hard and it brings out a safety car. What did you make of that incident?
It looked like Raikkonen didn't know he was there at all.
Yeah.
Like, he just, there was no hesitation in his turn. He just turned in and collided with the torpedo. And it's enough of a collision to just instantly break his suspension and put Raikkonen headlong into a wall.
Yeah. That was kind of my first reaction was, oh shit, Kvyat, he's back up to his old tricks. on replay, he had a really good run.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like going back to the very beginning of the race with Ricardo on, oh, who was it? It's the first place it goes bad. Like, looking at it again, it looks like, oh, it's lap 34 Ricardo on Giovinazzi. Like, it looked tantalizing. The door was open. It's one of those things that, like, in retrospect, you can see it being just too small to do, but so appealing that it makes sense that a racing driver would go for it.
Yeah, and I feel like Raikkonen should have had an instinct, at least, that somebody would be coming down that line, because Kvyat was coming up fast. That might have been a place to be a little more cautious. But racing incident, I would say. Brings out the safety car yet again, proving the axiom that safety cars do indeed breed safety cars. This time, Vettel's usually been pretty cagey about stacking the field up and then taking off, like at the last corner. This time he kind of jumps it. He starts earlier, which is his right, but he starts it, like, I think two turns before he's done it before on the restart, and everyone is caught flat-footed, and this is where he really just sort of puts in his literal rear view any thought of Leclerc being in striking distance. He just drives off.
Yeah, I think it's actually the first safety car, but his team says, we will be racing Charles at the restart. And then, in so many words, don't take too many risks.
Yeah.
So it's not like me and my buddy are up here at the front. It's no, I need to leave this guy in my dust, because Leclerc is also given that K1 plus mode at this restart.
Yeah. It appears to achieve nothing.
Yeah.
Like, Vettel drives away easily. But at the same time, like, even this is just a brutal track to overtake at. It doesn't look like there's anything that Leclerc or anyone in that front of the field pack can do. They're basically all kind of locked into their positions. There remains some good action behind all of this. Or at least there's a lot of fun to be had watching people overtake Magnussen.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, Stroll is complaining that it feels like the car is broken and it feels like he's going to crash. While he's saying that, he's turning some of his fastest laps and is executing some pretty good overtaking maneuvers. So, I don't know. It's sometimes cars can just be really fast and also very uncomfortable and scary to drive. And it sounds like that may be where he ended up with the Force India. But nevertheless, he sounded pretty close to panicking on that radio call.
I saw Hamilton say after the race, or I think after qualifying maybe, about Leclerc's pole lap, that it looked like he was all over the place. You know, and I think Leclerc even said that he almost lost it a number of times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lap on the limit, baby.
And then from there, it's pretty much a procession. There's no more safety cars. Leclerc can't do anything. He just has to watch Vettel take a win on a weekend where Leclerc probably feels pretty justly that he did everything right and everything that was asked of him, and he got screwed on a strategy call. And it makes for a really awkward dynamic in the pit lane celebration. David Coulthard is there to do the interview. And do you want to go through standings before we start getting into the post-race stuff and all the politics around this?
Sure. Yeah, I had two more bullet points from right toward the end there. Hamilton does get pretty close to Verstappen, and then Verstappen asks, I need more power, and the response is just negative. But Verstappen does hold him off for third place, Leclerc in second, and Hamilton in first. Interestingly, Magnussen had to pit because of a plastic bag getting sucked into his radiator. They also cleaned that out and put on new tires, and just like last year, Magnussen gets the fastest lap. And thus denies it from anyone else in the top 10 because he is outside the top 10. So no one gets the point. But yeah, it's Ferrari's first time they've won three in a row since 2008 and the first 1-2 finish since Hungary 2017. Vettel's first win in 392 days. And behind those three, we've got Lewis Hamilton in fourth, Valtteri Bottas in fifth, Alex Albon coming home in sixth. Best of the rest, Lando Norris in seventh, Pierre Gasly in eighth, Nico Hülkenberg in ninth, and Antonio Giovinazzi in 10th place. He actually earned a 10-second penalty for passing too close to a crane during one of the safety cars, but it did not bump him down to 11th place, much to Roman Grosjean's chagrin, who's completing the race in 11th place. Behind him, Sainz, Stroll, Ricciardo in 14th, Kvyat, Kubica, and Magnussen. DNFs, Raikkonen, Perez, and George Russell.
So, in the pits, David Coulthard asks the question that's on everyone's mind. He asks Seb, and Seb doesn't seem to understand the question at first because he's doing the usual, like, great weekend for the team, all this stuff. But he asks Seb, was this a strategy that your side of the garage had? Did you make the call to go for the undercut? And Seb says, oh, I don't know. I thought the call was a little early, but we did it and it worked great. And Coulthard clarifies, like, no, but like, did you decide when to do this or were you told? Was this a team decision? Was it your side of the garage? And Seb's like, no, I was just told. And when Coulthard goes and talks to Leclerc, he asks a similar question, and Leclerc knows exactly what he's driving at and says, no, I did exactly what my team told me. I drove the race as called, and I didn't know the strategy was in play. I didn't know it was a possibility. And apparently I missed this. I missed this during the race, but apparently on the cooldown lap, Binotto gets on the radio to Leclerc, congratulates him on a good race, and Leclerc kind of keeps him arm's length, shrugs it off, and Binotto gets impatient and just sort of apparently like kind of snaps at him like punto, meaning no more, we're done, we're not going to talk about this here, and I don't know. This is you know, I'm going to kick it over to you. What do you make of what happened to Charles this weekend?
I think it is simply Ferrari being ruthless in their pursuit of points. I think they traded a Leclerc 1, Vettel 3 for a Vettel 1, Leclerc 2. And they don't care about anyone's feelings about that. They've been a very conservative team from a strategy standpoint. And I think back when they were looking at pit stops, if they had pitted, I think it's Brundle that assumes that they didn't pit Leclerc first because he would have come out behind Hülkenberg, which Vettel just came out in front of. So I think, you know, their allegiance is to, you know, Maranello, not to any of the drivers that they have. They are, they should be so lucky to race for us. They work for us. It doesn't matter. So it just, it feels very cold and calculating, but it's not surprising to me, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. It's funny. I was pretty much cool with it all during the race. Like, to me, I understood why Leclerc was furious, but at the same time, it's not like the race was totally handed to Vettel on a silver platter. He had to execute the strategy. He had to get away from Leclerc a couple times. He did it successfully each time. Now, admittedly, at Singapore, that's not so hard to do if you have the track position. But I sort of understood exactly that logic you laid out in terms of why you make this decision, who you like, prioritizing the team over the driver. Something about Binotto's style is not sitting well with me, though.
I think it's, for me, it's because I know that Mercedes would have said something, as they have to Bottas in the past, like, sorry, Valtteri, we're doing this because blah, 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 blah. Sorry. And then after the race, you know, Bottas goes, yeah, well, I understand why they did it. Leclerc is left in the dark and they don't tell him anything during the race. He's just left to kind of go like, I guess it's good for the team. No one told me anything. Well, I'm confused.
And they didn't tell him that Vettel was pushing apparently as hard as he was. So like,
he
didn't get on the throttle as much as he could have.
And he didn't know Vettel had pitted at all.
Right. And that swap. So the thing is, the Vettel swap would have worked whether or not, I think it would have worked regardless of what Leclerc did. I'm thinking back now because Hamilton was opposite Leclerc, but the overcut wasn't going to work anyway. So Mercedes was on a losing strategy. If you remember, Leclerc came out pretty close behind Vettel. I want to say there wasn't that much daylight between them, was there?
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think there's that leaving them in the dark aspect. And to be fair, like, I don't know how much of this is then handled maybe in Italian language press, in the wake of these races, but there seems to be something there's just a weird vibe between Binotto and, Leclerc that makes me a little bit uneasy. The entire thing last week about right when Leclerc has won the biggest race of Ferrari's year, sort of making the point, you know, today you are forgiven. There is something that feels small about the way Binotto is handling a situation.
Like, remember, you work for us, stay in your lane.
Yeah. And it's making, and the thing is, like, maybe I'm being naive. I really don't see this coming from Vettel. Like, I just don't get the sense that there's any machinations here from the Vettel
because
side.
Because he's proved himself in the past at Red Bull, I guess.
And he just seems oblivious to the dynamics around him a little bit. He seemed kind of amazed the strategy had worked out so well. So unless he's really, like, playing up his naivete, it just doesn't seem like he was, angling to sort of nip this win out from under Leclerc. So really the weird vibe around Ferrari seems to be entirely about the way Binotto and Leclerc are getting along. And that bodes poorly, I think, because I'm not sure Ferrari's fortunes turn around as successfully as they have this year without both of those guys delivering the goods. And so I'm a little bit nervous as I consider how that race ended, as I consider Binotto's sort of ham-handed attempt to talk to Charles after, as I consider last week. There's something uncomfortable about Ferrari right now, and I am concerned about how it's going to come together. That being said, it does, like, if Binotto's trying to leave a mark, he's made it very clear, team above all. To your point, mm-hmm. You are lucky to be a Ferrari driver. It's the team, not the driver.
Yeah, I have the official party line here from Binotto on the Formula1.Ferrari.com website. He says, "We had to bring Vettel in first to protect his position because Max Verstappen was about to pit, and that was Seb's best chance to overtake Hamilton. Also, we knew that on the following lap, we would have pitted Charles, so it was important not to stop both drivers on the same lap. The undercut was very effective. Seb drove very fast and very well on new tires in that part of the race and gained the position to go ahead of Charles, which is part of racing."
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that explains everything, but it kind of explains everything.
Yeah.
All right. Should we move on to the next race, Rob Zachney?
Yes.
Any other news you want to hit? Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay. Yeah, maybe news
silly
in between
season.
The races. Silly season.
I think...
Not done yet.
First of all, the sad news first. Kubica Watch is canceled. We watched. We didn't see a lot.
And now our watch is over.
Yeah, Kubica is done at Williams. He said that he is not going to stay with the team at the end of the season. It looks like this is Kubica making that call. It seems like Williams may have been happy to have him around for another year, but he wants to be done with this Formula One comeback, or at least his time with Williams. He has had talks to go over to DTM. He just hasn't been competitive with his own teammate at all. He is considerably slower than Russell. He's clearly not got the skill set that he had before, and not anywhere close to it. There's just too much data indicating that he is not a very competitive F1 driver right now, even if he's got great skills and instincts. Haas may be recruiting him for sim work, but Kubica has said he's not super interested in doing sim work. So it looks like he's going to be maybe angling for a move into sports cars or something like that. But it is unfortunate. There's been a lot of praise. It has been inspiring and cool to see Kubica make a comeback. At the same time, it has served as kind of a bittersweet reminder of just what a brilliant Formula One career didn't materialize for some really unfortunate reasons. but that it, well, that seems to be Kubica done in a F1 driving capacity. Who knows how else we might see him around the paddock in the future. But no, the thing we got to get to before we get to the next race is, you know, like I always said, Haas are going to stick with their driver lineup. you know, you wouldn't change horses in midstream with a team like this, with two stallions pulling your wagon, Magnussen, Roman fucking Grosjean. And so Haas made the entirely predictable decision. I think there's multiple shows where you can hear me talking about this. Made the entirely predictable decision to stick with Grosjean, despite some people thinking that Nico Hülkenberg was a lock for the seat.
Ridiculous. Who would say that? I have two competing emails here.
Yeah.
First comes from Drone. Why in the world would any F1 team pay money to keep Roman Grosjean behind the wheel of a car? I mean, especially with Nico Hülkenberg available. He has more points than Grosjean and doesn't crash as often. What is the Haas team thinking with holding on to him? And the next email from Unsigned. I don't get why people went crazy when Grosjean was chosen over Hülkenberg. I mean, they have closely the same amount of races and Grosjean has 10 podium finishes. If even Haas admits their car is the problem, is Hulk that better of a choice if records say otherwise? I'd get it if they wanted to shake things up, make headlines, but I just didn't freak out over their choice for Grosjean.
So, in all seriousness, what do you make of this?
I make of this that Haas has no idea what's going on with their car. Grosjean has been with them since the start and is probably the best judge of where the car has been and how the changes are going. I think at this point they need to, such is their experience, they need to stay with their experience. I think it's just a testament to not Grosjean's ability, but Haas's instability.
Also, you know, Gunther's going to be happy just like negging Roman for an entire new season. Just
I don't know if I would want it if I was Grosjean.
No. There's a part of me that'd be like, fuck, I was hoping this decision would be taken out of my hands.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, Martin Brundle made a comment during qualifying that he'd been talking to people up and down the paddock because a lot of people didn't get this move. Like, the feeling is pretty much universal that, in terms of like one-to-one comparison, Hülkenberg is a better driver than Grosjean. You're getting more value from Nico Hülkenberg than you are Roman Grosjean. But Hülkenberg's asking price was apparently a little high, and there were hints that Grosjean may have a bit of sponsorship potential or a little bit of sponsor backing that Haas was loath to part with. And so if those two unknowable factors were there behind the scenes, which is that Hülkenberg would have made a meaningful difference to the budget of the Haas F1 team, as well as Grosjean comes with an amount of money that makes a meaningful difference, suddenly that's two things that cut really strongly against changing that up for the sake of Hülkenberg. That's also maybe a little bit of insight into where Haas is in terms of sort of being penny wise. Whether that's pound foolish remains to be seen, but I think you make a good point. It certainly is Steiner's position, which is that we sucked this year because the car sucked. And the person who probably did more to fix that is Roman Grosjean. So to a degree, he gets another shot. And it's kind of down to Haas to deliver a better car next year and then see how these guys do.
Yeah, I just feel for Hülkenberg. I mean, we still have some unconfirmed spots here. Toro Rosso is unconfirmed. Kvyat and whatever's happening with Albon and Gasly. Giovinazzi is unconfirmed. Stroll is unconfirmed. And Williams is number two is currently open. I have a feeling, well, I don't know. I think a strong contender for that Williams number two spot is Nicholas Latifi from Formula 2. He's currently their reserve driver and has the super license points to race in Formula 1. That seems like a shoe-in to me. Giovinazzi has been getting better and better as the season goes on, although if you were to put Hülkenberg and Raikkonen in a team, I think that would there'd be a lot of talent in that for a team on the rise. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough. I think Hülkenberg is a tough guy to place right now. Because I think there's a lot of teams that are looking to see, can we lock up any young talent that's not Hülkenberg anymore?
True.
And I'm not sure, like, a team like a Williams is a similar thing to Haas in some ways, which is that we're not really in a position where we know what a good driver is going to get us, because clearly we need to do so much technical development that it's going to be a bit before we see the comparative advantage of an old hand like Hülkenberg. So it's tough. He seems really well regarded in the sport, and that might save him. He seems to be so well respected in F1 that he might be the rare driver who is just the top free agent with no downside. So if you can afford him, it makes sense. Someone will pull the trigger, but there's just not that many someones left.
Well, 20 someones will be driving around Sochi this weekend. Rob, can you tell us about the track on the edge of the Black Sea?
Well, Drew, I hate it. so,
what are you talking about? It's got that big circle.
It sure does. The Sochi circuit is built as part of the Sochi Olympic Park. We all saw this a lot during the Sochi Olympics. We can recognize the landscape around it. It is a 5.84 kilometer course. It's a Tilke design, of course. 18 turns. It's most iconic. It might be 17 turns. I've seen different counts for the turn, but the most iconic turn is the one around the Olympic, like the medal
courtyard.
Podium. Yeah. Yeah. That ends up being this long, like carousel left hander. That's considered two different turns as part of that left. But it is the most iconic course turn on the course. It's also maybe the only really interesting one. It's a long sweeping left. But beyond that, this is a course of sharp right angle corners, short straights. And it's not a particularly narrow course, but there's not a lot of room to get it wrong, right? There's a bit of runoff. There's room to get cars side by side, but the problem is there's not enough runoff to recover from a mistake, and there's barriers pretty much everywhere. So I think this to me has always read like a track that doesn't necessarily generate a ton of good racing action, though it does tend to generate dramatic incidents. But anyway, it starts on a short straight, and then it makes a quick dogleg right-hander into the longest straight on the course. This is the first DRS zone. On the standing start, of course, it will be that turn will be a little more meaningful, but at full race pace, that is basically just a flat-out turn one through that dogleg. And then you are racing pretty much straight to a sharp right that leads into the left-hander around the Olympic, the old podium. And you come out of that long left into another right turn that ends up going around the Bolshoi Ice Arena. But the sector, I think the most famous incident to have happened in the big long left is where Kvyat basically threw away his first Formula One career because it was there that Kvyat in 2016 tagged the back of Vettel heading into that turn. And then after they both recovered, ran up the back of him again and hit him hard and spun him all the way around in that corner. So, like, at the start of the race, tapped Vettel and then just hit him with a sledgehammer. and pretty much at that point, everyone recognized it was maybe time to get Kvyat out of that Red Bull, because there have been some incidents. But that's probably the most infamous incident to happen there. Mm-hmm. You come out of that turn at turn four, you make the right, you head down to the Bolshoi Ice Arena. The track just sort of cuts around it with a series of hard rights. Then you end up in kind of a slow section. You got a short run away from the ice arena to a tight turn eight and nine that almost feel like one long Boeing left-hander. And then that leads you to a sharp right-handed turn 10. That takes you to the other DRS zone, but it's not a straight. The track kind of describes a shallow S-curve at this mm-hmm. point. You end up making sort of a sweeping right, and then there's a dog leg to the left, and that leads to a tight turn 14, it ends with a hard right at turn 14, and then a hard left at turn 15. And then you take another short run, and you come to, it's not quite a chicane. There are two distinct corners at 15 and 16, but they act like one. It's a bit like a slightly elongated version of the bus stop, where you end up making two really hard right turns that basically dump all your speed all at once. And then you go to what looks like someone took a long, like almost like a parabolica corner and just squared off the end. And that's turn 18 and 19. Again, two separate corners, but, and this is kind of a Tilke trademark, you can take them effectively as one. Those last two corners, you end up basically treating as one flowing right rather than two distinct right turns. And then that takes you back to timing and scoring.
This track looks to me like someone trying to figure out how to use the Bezier tool in Adobe Illustrator. I don't know if you've ever used that to make like a polygon, maybe in Photoshop or something. You click the pen and then you're like, click, 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 click. Oh, I made a weird looking shape. What if I hold this? Oh, it makes a curve. Click, 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 click. All right.
Yeah. You know,
what is this?
To me, it just feels like there was this era in stadium design where like everyone had this idea that the future of stadiums, of pro sports stadiums, is multi-purpose arenas. Don't build a great baseball park. Build a great multi-purpose arena. And there was like this generation of sports stadiums that just suck. Like, like people just hate them.
Brother, I lived in the East Bay growing up. The Raiders / Oakland Athletics.
The Coliseum?
Stadium. The Coliseum is just this brutalist monstrosity.
Yeah, and in Chicago, when they tore down Comiskey, they put up, I think people still call it New Comiskey. I don't know what the naming rights are now, but just a terrible place to see a game. and probably not a great place to see a concert. Infamously, I think there's something similar to that in Toronto. But the point is, this feels like the racetrack equivalent of that, where they built this Olympic Village, and they're like, damn, we got to get something else out of this. And so they like traced a racetrack through it, and we're like, that's a venue, right? And called it a day. Like, I don't particularly care for this track, but it does generate some enjoyable miscues, I would say. The person who does seem to enjoy this track is Valtteri Bottas. He holds the race lap record of a minute 35.861. He was on the pole last year with a 131.3. Not sure we're going to see that time fall. We've seen a lot of records fall this year, but at Singapore, what we realized is that we are starting to hit the point where the less sophisticated front wing aerodynamics of the 2019 cars are leaving time on the table. that the 2018 car scooped up. And so I'm not sure we see that record break. I'm not sure this is as front wing a dependent a track as Singapore is, but I am really curious to see whether the less sophisticated front aerodynamics change the times we see here. Vettel and Hamilton.
I'm sorry, one of those people that does not care about lap time. It doesn't matter to me that the cars aren't as fast as they have been before. All I want to do is see good racing. And if you have to, simplify the front wing to get rid of the very turbulent wake to make the cars closer, that's fine. I don't care what the lap record is, frankly.
I just need you to continue to radicalize yourself into eventually, the only real racing is a touring car. the real problem we have here is wings. And we should get rid of those. I'm with you. I'm academically curious about it, but I am hoping we see some good duels. Vettel and Hamilton had a good one there last year. This is also the race, probably the low point of Valtteri's season. He was arguably team ordered out of the Hamilton's way on lap 25 last year. I think it was less clear that the race was his in the bag. But what is undeniable is he dominated here in 2017, and arguably there's a body of work that suggests Valtteri Bottas might be the master of Sochi, and so this might be a good opportunity for him to not just diminish the deficit to Hamilton's. I don't think that championship battle is really still on, but also just take the fight back to Ferrari and can sort of continue having his return to form that we've seen this year. Memorably in 2017, this is also the track where Alonso just called it a day at the end of the formation lap.
Wait, I don't remember this. What happened?
Yeah, I didn't remember it either. I was looking up stuff that happened in 2017. Apparently, I think 2017 is the year the cars go around on formation lap. And then as cars are forming up on the grid, you see Alonso pulled over, I think near pit entrance, but I'm not sure he made it all the way in. I think he got it out of the racing line so they could start the race, but he didn't bring it back to the pits, and he just got out of the car and walked away.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, that year also Grosjean took out Julian Palmer. At turn one, a very similar incident to Kvyat and Vettel in 2016. So turn one and that sweeping left, thing to watch for the first corner, because there's enough room and enough speed there for a lot of things to go wrong. And while the racing line isn't difficult at race pace, with that many cars, it does prove to be kind of a tricky funnel.
Yeah, turn two as well. That's a sharp one. And then you got...
Sorry, turn two is... I always forget turn one is there. No, turn two, the entrance to that long left. You're right.
Yeah.
That's the one where there's enough of a corner you can cut where people can make some bad decisions.
Yeah. And if you have any problem with your car, you might be slow in that long left and people might tag you from behind.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it makes sense that Bottas holds the race lap record here. I think, listen, I love Valtteri Bottas, but if I were to pick one person whose personality closely matched the Sochi track, I think it would be Valtteri Bottas.
Wow.
Pirelli tires, we got the C2, C3, and C4. Only a handful of people taking two hards. It's mostly one hard, and then three mediums and nine softs. That seems to be about the breakdown. Ricciardo, though, taking two hards, one medium, and 10 softs. Same with Raikkonen. The top six, only Bottas has taken two hards. Most everybody else is just one hard, three mediums. Oh, Lewis has got four mediums. So, all right, some different tire strategies.
Yeah. Valtteri, the king of Sochi, being like, I'll do it on one.
High downforce track, according to Pirelli. These are the middle hardness compounds of Pirelli's tire range. Let's get to the weather. Interesting. Qualifying day looks to be around 69, 70 degrees Fahrenheit or around 20 degrees Celsius. High, high humidity with a 43% chance of rain. Not very high winds, 8 miles an hour or... just 5 miles an hour or 8 kilometers an hour. Sunday, slightly higher winds, lower precipitation, unfortunately, only 5%. And slightly higher temperatures, 22 degrees Celsius or 71 Fahrenheit. So, qualifying day could get funky, but race day looks to be... I wouldn't want to be sitting in a race car, though. That temperature with that humidity. Let's run down the standings here. Things have gotten very interesting with the Singapore race. Lewis Hamilton on top, of course, with 296 points. Valtteri Bottas second with 231. Behind him, we have a tie for third place between Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen with 200 points. Then just behind them, Sebastian Vettel with 194, only 6 points behind. Then we jump down quite a bit to Pierre Gasly in sixth place with 69 points. Carlos Sainz has 58. Alex Albon has 42. Couldn't help yourself, could you? Ricardo has 34 points. And Danny Kvyat and Nico Hülkenberg tied in 10th place with 33 points. Lando and Raikkonen tied with 31. Then we got Perez with 27. Stroll with 19. Magnussen has 18. Grosjean with 8. Antonio Giovinazzi with 4 points. Robert Kubica with 1. And George Russell with 0. Constructors, Mercedes has 527. Ferrari with 394. Red Bull's got 289. McLaren with 89 points. Renault with 67. Scuderia Toro Rosso with 55 points. Racing Points got 46. Alfa Romeo with 35. Gene Haas and team, 26 points. And Williams with their 1. In the Fantasy League standings, I'm going to do things a little differently here. I got a suggestion to the emails saying that you can actually see how everyone did per race. So in Singapore, I'll do the top five here. Number five, the nut behind the wheel racing team. Tied for third place was the speed was okay, but the corner was too tight. And this team Haas to win. In second place, oh geez. W Ast Honda Martag Roush Bull Citrix Racing 66.com. That's a team name. And in first
place,
might
be Haas' sponsor next year.
The team that did the best at the Singapore Grand Prix was Maldonado with apostrophe OH. They had Norris, Leclerc, Grosjean, Albon with turbo mode, Verstappen, and the Ferrari team. But top five overall. In fifth place, G's Mercedes driver team hedged by Ferrari. Fourth place is St. Giovese Racing Team. Third place is Dragon Ball GT. Two is To the Future Part 3. And number one, Rich Volt F1 Energy Team paintwork pending. Have you seen Rich Energy's Twitter account that's basically just now serves to drag Haas?
No. Now, I mean, now you're making me look this up.
I wish I didn't, because it's just the pettiest, dumb, juvenile thing. Like, they had a picture of when Grosjean crashed into Russell.
Wait, did I find the right account?
It's Rich underscore Energy.
No, I know.
Yeah, it just looks like
super pro-Brexit, too.
Oh, is it? That doesn't surprise me. But yeah, they posted a picture of that and just said, oops. It's awful. It's run by awful people. If you'd like to send us some non-awful emails, you can do so at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com. Got two here. One from Steve. Rob, are you still mesmerized by Rich Energy's Twitter account?
Oh, yeah, because apparently Rich Energy is the one spreading the rumor that Haas is going to sell to a Saudi investment group.
Yes.
I was wondering where that story came from.
Yeah, and I think it's where I saw this. They retweeted Autosport saying that Haas denies this, and then Rich Energy responded saying Autosport has their facts wrong or something. Just, it's the most, I almost don't even want to talk about him anymore.
No, I really don't, but at the same time, now I can't look away again.
I know.
I've fallen back down that, like, this is now just some dude's Twitter. It's just a boring dude's Twitter.
Yep. It's
okay.
All
right. Back to our regularly scheduled emails.
Emails. Yeah. Before we go away from Singapore here, do you want to read this one from Steve?
Yeah. Hey guys, love the pod. Just wanted to add some info about the fires, haze issues in Singapore, just because I live in Indonesia and it's actually a super fucked up thing. So that haze in Singapore and Malaysia too is generated from fires on the islands of Sumatra and Kalimantan in Indonesia. At the moment, there are reportedly over 2,000 different hotspots, and 80% of the fires have been deliberately lit to clear land for palm oil plantations. The palm oil that's contained in an absolute ton of products, so everybody wants their piece of the money-making action. Before the fire started this year, Jakarta, where I live, was regularly the most polluted city in the world, with air quality readings in the 180s. But the places near where those fires have been lit are experiencing air quality readings of between 300 to 600, which is crazy high. Like, the 180 air quality level in Singapore as I write this is awful, but imagine being even closer to where the burns are happening. Schools are having to be closed, airports can't operate because there's too much haze. It's horrible. It's basically the equivalent of the fires that happened in the Amazon forest, just on a slightly smaller but still enormous scale. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure it was clear that this is very much a man-made issue caused by lax policing and humans being terrible. People will die from respiratory issues. Orangutans will die and lose a ton of habitat. In the next few years, this will happen on the scale again, and the Indonesian government will continue to throw their hands up and be like, who could have predicted this? While neighboring countries like Singapore and Malaysia have to suffer for a problem they can do nothing about. Thanks for the pod, and keep up with the good work.
Thanks, Steve. That sounds bad. One thing I like about Formula One is that we do sort of, by virtue of the fact that we're going to different places every week, we do get to shine a light a little bit on things around the world. It breaks us out of our bubble. Speaking of which, Faiz, I'm going with, sent us a note saying, I was watching Will Buxton's post-qualifying YouTube video this Saturday. During the interview with Perez, they referred to, quote, putting trust in Bernie to come up with a workable strategy. I was quite surprised to hear that she is Bernadette Collins, Racing Point's chief strategy engineer. I was totally unaware that there were any women even close to the top of the decision-making hierarchy of any of these teams, aside from the unique case of Claire Williams. F1 has tried hard in the past few years to make it less of a boys' club, so I'm surprised we never heard more about her. Do you know if there are any women in any position of particular authority? Any other women? In any case, it's given me one more small reason to root for Racing Point down the stretch. I agree with you there. I'm not sure I agree if they've tried hard in the past few years to make it less of a boys' club, because I think you're right. I think they could do better to highlight, I think, really anyone else behind the scenes of these teams. I think it's something that maybe we don't get, because we don't get the Sky F1 channel is essentially what it is. I've heard in the UK where they do a lot of, feature videos, behind the scenes stuff. They talk to more people.
Yeah.
I think that would give a much better, I would like to see Buxton, cause he's F1's YouTube, producer, I suppose. And he's got the access. I would like to see them do more of that kind of stuff that Sky does for that YouTube channel.
I'm just laughing here because I remember when Buxton first started popping up on the NBC broadcast.
Yeah, NBC Sports Network.
Have been. I think he totally missed the speed era, but I think he hopped on for NBC. And it's funny watching him having gone from being clearly somebody who wanted a lot of access but didn't necessarily have a great deal of it to being someone who actually is pretty wired up with what's happening in the world of F1. Because it was very funny, like, in his early years of his career, how much more he knew about, like, backmarker type guys. And, like, they were kind of his window into F1 because he wasn't getting the interviews with the big names.
Right. NBC, is that an American channel?
Yeah, exactly. People just kind of blew him off.
Yeah.
The other thing I miss is the Will Buxton track walk. Not track walk, but grid walk. Because they were the most perilous grid walks I've ever seen. He's got a very sort of anxiety-inducing style.
It's frantic.
Yeah, he's got a lot of nervous energy, and he would just barrel through a busy F1 grid with his camera guys trailing along, and you were just constantly waiting for him to just get clobbered with a tire or trip over someone's wing or like misstep and like snap someone's front end plate. Oh, it was terrifying. But in terms of this question, I agree. I'm not sure how much F1 has really done to address this issue, but it's interesting. I see now an increasing number of women in the various garages. But we don't know who they are because you know the names of the team principals, and then you know the names of important people in the big three, right? Like, we hear when a director of development or something departs Ferrari, we know those people's names. We don't really, we're not on, a first-name basis with them. You never hear about strategy calls from Racing Point because they just don't get covered much. I didn't realize that Bernadette Collins was running strategy over Racing Point, but Racing Point strategy is rarely where the race is being decided. So we just tend to not see these contributions.
That's a good point. Yeah. Well, contributing to the world of racing this weekend, everyone, is Formula 2, who will be supporting Formula 1 in Sochi. Then we've got the NASCAR Xfinity Series at Charlotte Motor Speedway for the Drive for the Cure 300. World Superbike is a Magny Cours in France for round 11. MXGP is at TT Circuit Assen for the Monster Energy FIM Motocross Grand Prix of Assen. The NHRA is at the Gateway Motorsports Park in Madison, IL for the AAA Insurance Midwest Nationals. Super Formula is at the Okoyama Circuit in Takemiya, Mimisakashi, Okoyama Prefecture, Japan. And we got NASCAR. They're still at Charlotte, along with those Xfinity boys, for the playoff race called the Bank of America Roval 400. It's like a road, but it's an oval.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
That's the name of the company, or it's a road?
No, it's Bank of America, but they're calling the race the Roval.
It's kind of good, and I hate it.
Yeah. Formula One, however, first practice kicks off September 27th, Friday, at 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Then we got second practice at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. Third practice the following day, September 28th, Saturday, 5 a.m., followed by qualifying at 8 a.m. And the race, Rob Zachney, September 29th, Sunday, at 7:10 a.m. I don't have the ESPN channels because ESPN hasn't updated their page on that. So, apologies. Anything else, Rob?
Not too much. Just congrats to Alex Newgarden for winning IndyCar.
Joseph?
Yeah, Joseph. Well, you know, close
There's
counts.
Probably an Alex out there.
But yeah, my DVR screwed me. I didn't get to watch Laguna Seca, which killed me, because it is one of my favorite tracks. But for some reason, well, no, I know what happened, which is that Comcast just died on me for most of Sunday, and so I just missed most of that race. But it was a pretty dramatic finish to a good IndyCar season.
Awesome. Yeah, I feel like I should really, now that the season's concluded, maybe I can find, although last time I checked, it was difficult for me to find a, like, they don't have a Formula One TV style thing. There's no, like,
no.
on-demand archive.
No, and the, I've gotten really spoiled by the, just taking the Sky TV production, and thanks to our good friends at Mothers, being able to see it commercial-free. Watching Formula One on cable TV, like right now, commercial-free. You go watch Indy, it's like, well, we're going to go to commercial again, and that duel you can see taking shape, our producer doesn't see it, and so we'll be back when it's done.
Yeah.
We'll get it on replay.
Yeah, hopefully they, I don't know. I don't know if IndyCar is big enough to warrant a,
That's their own thing.
So... all right. Well, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. We have yet to schedule our next Patreon thing, but we have an idea about what it's going to be. I think you guys will enjoy it. But yeah, looking forward to Russian time. So until then, have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.